introduce to you Bobby.
Thank you. I am Bob Earl. I am a drug addict and an alcoholic. And thrilled and delighted and honored to be at the third roundup. It's really a pleasure. I'm glad to be back. I think the energy here is great. I think you're in for a tremendous roundup. I mean, you got a lot of outstanding speakers. I haven't heard Sandy in forever, and I'm looking forward to hearing him and all the rest of the speakers, Duffy and Irish Yanny and Clancy, because it's a lot of energy. Coming over the hill in the van was nice. There's a lot of energy in the van of all kinds, just cooking, you know. And I got here and took a little run on the beach and, had some dinner and didn't have my glasses, so I overpaid my check by $30. No sense carrying the crap out to the light where I could see it, you know. It's one of the serious faults throughout my sobriety has been a need to look good at all costs. And unfortunately, there's usually a price tag attached. you never know, you know, I'd say. You could have had lunch, Mike, for Christ's sake. Annie had a hamburger, didn't bother her. I was there at the table, didn't you? Well, you know, it's interesting. It's, I have a lot of fun with all me today. This is me. This is who I brought, and I'm not sure exactly what the talk is all going to be about, but some of the things that are important to me today, one of them is nutrition, another one of them is exercise, and you may hear me talk about some of this stuff, and I hope to tell you how I got there, because today this stuff is part of my life, a very important part of my life. I made a decision a while back, which is I would really like to not die from a degenerative disease, you know? I like to just go out, whatever age I go out, as an old man dying from old age. I just hate to go from emphysema or cancer or contact diabetes at age 60 because I've consumed 3,600 tons of sugar in 25 years of sobriety. But this stuff was not always important to me. I used to weigh more than I weigh now and smoke and do a lot of things and be a voracious meat eater. And so I'll try and tell you how it changed. And it changed here. And it changed in AA. And it changed with tools outside of AA that the program gives me permission to go out and seek and use. And so if anything at all, I stand here tonight, you know, I'm 22 years sober, almost 50 years age, and I'm just really grateful as hell. I couldn't be. And I'm grateful to be here. I like the seaside, and I like people up in this part of the country. And I'm getting mellower and peacefuler as I do. And where I live becomes less and less acceptable to me. Unfortunately, I'm still there. I've run into a wall and have yet to turn left. For those of you who don't know the story, it was somebody shared with me once a very simple philosophy about God, and I love it, which is just get up in the morning, go out the door, and start moving. And when you hit a wall, turn left. It's that difficult to trust God. I have found that myself and most other AAs I know have hit the wall and just stay. You know? Well, it's not too bad here, you know. It's, not exactly what I had in mind, but. Or if you have high metabolism, you'll get back and take a 100-yard run at the wall. And it'll cave in, you'll be on the other side, you'll have what you want and wonder why the hell you went through the wall in the first place, you know. Here a while back, I was over in Honolulu for a marathon a couple of years ago or last year, not this one, this December, but December before. And over there was a gal who really impressed me. And she reached deep inside of me and just shook every fiber of my being. 3 years prior to that, let's see, this was 84, 83, so 1980, she was in Houston. And a runner, training to come run the Honolulu Marathon. Serious runner. She lived in Ohio. Beautiful girl. Very beautiful girl. And she'd gone from Ohio to Houston to train for this marathon so she could run in the humidity, to get accustomed to the humidity so that when she got to Honolulu, it wouldn't, you know, wipe her out. And so running was very serious. And she was running in this park with Houston, in Houston, and she was shot by a sniper who, no one she knew, no particular reason, just a sniper in the park shooting at random people. And the bullet severed her spine and paralyzed her. So I didn't know any of this until I met her in Hawaii. And when I met her, she was there in Honolulu 3 years after being shot in the spine, entered in the wheelchair marathon. And she won it. For women. And after it was over, I just, you know, watched her. And I saw in her that spirit, you know. That great human spirit. That spirit that says, yeah, let's go for it. And give it our best. And I'm convinced that that spirit exists in every one of us that's here tonight, sober. That spirit got us here. We may think we got here because we're sick and tired of dying, but to be sick and tired of dying, you gotta have something in you that wants something else, or you'll accept the dying, because we all know people who have accepted the dying and chosen that way. And it seems to me like, from the time I got here, after a while, I had this great spirit, this childlike, this child energy in me that is unbounded. It's just incredible. And yet, in my opinion, I have spent 22 years trying to shut it up. I have put a lot of energy into holding it down. A lot of energy into not dealing with it or coping with it. And that's for a lot of reasons. In the beginning, in sobriety, like the beginning was, you know, the beginning was the beginning. You're nuts and you follow instructions. And, you know, you make coffee where you're told, sit where you're told, mop the floor as you're told to mop. Yeah, you know, you either love it or hate it. I happen to hate it. You do all these things until you, some of the wiring gets restored and then you begin to think. Once the thinking process began for me, the trouble began for me. I probably could have been a very happy guy living somewhere in a charmed life if I could have just not ever hooked the wiring back up and begun to think. Because I am the only one, really, truly, who in my life works against my own best interests. Nobody else is ever out there wiping me out, telling me about things I can't do. I'm the only one who sits home spending all this time telling myself about the things I cannot do, things I cannot accomplish, goals I cannot achieve. And it's interesting, in sobriety, I was forced to surrender spiritually about 4.5 years in, almost 5 years sober. It was that or die. It was trust an unseen God I had no idea or opinions or attitudes about with my life or die. And so I made the spiritual surrender. And out of that spiritual surrender, a lot of good things happened to me. On walking that path, I mean, I became a writer. I have no education. You know, I have a 10th grade education. I'm a phonetic speller, and I've failed English ever since the 4th grade. And yet I have earned my living for the last 17 years as a writer. So, you know, wow, God did that. But I also wiped myself out consistently throughout the 17 years in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of stuff that went on in sobriety that I never understood while it's going on. And now, with the aid of other tools, with the aid of therapy, a lot of stuff, I can look back now and see what the hell was happening with me, right? Like relationships and sobriety for me were a bitch. Yeah. God. Well, they never lasted long. You know? And I never understood why they didn't last long. And it never dawned on me that the role model I had for relationship was the original dynamic duo. Right? Mom and Dad. Well, I was raised by an alcoholic father, a non-alcoholic mother, who never spoke to each other for 14 years. And when they finally did, they had a fight, and he left. So, I mean, my relationships were secure until you disagreed with me. All right? And as insane as it sounds, the moment you disagreed with me, it set a mechanism inside of me to work. Saying, well, that's it. Now, I didn't say it to you. God, I mean, you know, to be confronted like that takes self-esteem. I just...
This is what I feel. You know, I never said that. I just began the plan to get away. You know. First wanting to find a replacement, because although I'm strong and independent, I don't want to be alone. You know what I mean?
So, I was unaware also that I had a lot of handicaps, i.e. in that not being in touch with my feelings, there wasn't really a lot to me except talk. So it's like a vaudeville performer who has three or four dances, you know, and a couple of songs that he does. And that's it. Okay? And in the beginning, when you first meet these girls, and it's better if they're, you know, around a year of sobriety or less. Because if they're sober longer, they already want more than you got going in, you know. Right? And in those days, when I was first sober, I picked women who were older, you know, because mother never did it right. I was trying to find somebody that would, you know. So I would do my three dances after the initial energy, which is always great. You know, you come together like two trains and nobody sees either one of you for 10 days to 2 weeks, you know. And you both surface and it's on a downhill slide from there. And I would sing my three songs and I would do my two dances, and then a couple of weeks would pass or a month would pass and they would be waiting for the next song, the next dance, and there wasn't one. Now, if you want to get rid of me quick, ask me to give you something I don't have that I can't admit that I don't have. Okay? So you look at me and say, I could stand to have a little more intimacy around here. A little more compassion and care and understanding. What the hell do you mean, compassion and care and understanding? I just bought you a brand new goddamn car. You know. What more do you want? I mean, how better can I show you I love you than spend 3 hours with a salesman talking to football, you know. But I didn't know. I didn't understand. And so when you ask me for what I ain't got and I can't tell you about, I'm gone. I'm not gone that moment, but I am working on it now. I'll do whatever I have to do to get gone. You know, and I would go to any length to get gone. All right? When I rolled into 8 years of sobriety, nothing, this behavior pattern had not really changed at all. You know, it was just, it was it. That was it. That was the shot. That was the best shot I could do. And then, when I was 8 years sober, I met a lady and I fell in love and we had a couple of years together. And then we got married, and 4 months after we got married, she died. And good things happened, and she was older and had been 11 years sober and had been on a year and a half slip and had just come back. So I was, you know, in pattern. You know, had nothing to change for me. Although I was 8 years sober now. But she had some gifts that she gave me. One of them was that although I had no self-esteem, and by that time I've been writing for 3 years, I always lived in this terrible fear that they were going to find me out. I don't know what the hell. I'm always worried they're going to find me out. And I keep asking my mind, what are they going to find out? And it just goes, don't worry, they're going to find out. And when they do, you're through, you know. So it's like, so I'm walking around knowing that I'm not really a writer, knowing this is really a joke, knowing this is fraudulent behavior on my part, knowing I've had really dumb luck. And this woman is excited by the fact that I'm a writer and thrilled with the process of writing and creating herself. And I learned to be, stand up a little bit. Say, because I would never tell people on an airplane or anything what I did. I was embarrassed. You know, because it's like, some people say, what do you do? I say, oh, you know, about what?
An immediate warm response, opening the door for communication, you know.
And it's like, I just couldn't tell people that what I did because I was ashamed. I was ashamed that I did something that was kind of interesting and paid money. I was ashamed. I didn't know why I was ashamed. I was just ashamed. And she gave me a little pride about that. And then she died. And I wasn't even in touch with my feelings enough after she died to feel the pain, to feel the horrible pain. I had to wait 10 more years to feel the pain. So after she died, the only thing that changed in my behavior pattern and picking people for relationships, interesting talk, I had no idea as I'm talking about it, and picking people for relationships was that somehow subconsciously I now had a horrendous fear that if you were older, you would get sick and die and leave me. And I didn't want that, so now I was dating girls all of whom were under 25. No longer older, just under 25, still about a year sober because they still went for the three zen, you know, and they liked the two songs. And it's like, so as long as I could do the dances and sing the songs, I was okay. Now, the only thing that helped the relationships last longer now was I was making a lot of money. Clap, girls, because they have it. You know, your sisters have got it. I sure as hell don't. I serve on the board of directors of a nonprofit foundation in Los Angeles, the Clare Foundation. They were looking for people to sit on the budget committee at our board meeting last night. I said, I'm sorry, I just can't volunteer with any sense of truth, you know, because my own personal deficit is percentage-wise bigger than the goddamn foundation's is. So I don't think I can give them a lot of sound fiscal advice. And it's like the only advantage the money gave me is I could throw things. You know, I could throw money at your requests for intimacy or your requests for love or compassion or requests for my time. I'd throw money. You know, this place too small, we'll get a bigger place. You know, I'll find you a place you like. And as we're moving in to the place you like, inside I'm saying, I hope you like it a lot because you're going to be here alone. Because I'm leaving. And the only reason I'm leaving is I've done my three dances and I sang my two songs. And I got nothing left to give you. Nothing left to give you. So, I rolled into my 17th birthday in AA and, I'll lead up to a couple of things. Because there were little pieces going on. After Taylor died, I gave up eating red meat. That was easy. That was a breeze because once they told her she had a few months to live, she refused any form of treatment that would kill her. If the treatment was toxic, she did not want the treatment. So we found ourselves dealing only with people who were involved in non-toxic treatments of cancer in this country and others. And the immediate thing they all took out of the diet and wanted to see gone was red meat. Because she had been a big meat eater, as I had. So that was an easy one to give up. I mean, it was like after she was gone, a week later, I said, I don't need to eat this crap anymore, and the fat content's too high, so screw it. And that one was easy. And a little while after that, about a year later, I gave up coffee. And I'd love to take a lot of credit for it, you know, but I can't. My throat just closed one morning and it wouldn't go down. And I drank a lot of coffee, you know, 25, 30 cups a day sitting at home working. And I didn't give up caffeine. Listen carefully to my words because I have a personality that will try and trick you. I gave up coffee, but I switched to Tab. I could knock off 3 6-packs of Tab a day
and tell you with my chest out how good it was that I didn't drink coffee while I'm pouring in caffeine from the cola, you know. But it was the best I could do at the time.
And as I got into about 15 years, I wanted to live, and I didn't even know why, and some churning was going on inside of me. And the next thing it seemed that came up to pass in my life was smoking. And I was a heavy smoker. And it's like, suddenly, I don't even know what brought the change about. And my wife, who died, had also been a heavy smoker. I started to look at people who didn't smoke. And I liked how they look. And I said, I didn't want to quit smoking, I wanted to be a non-smoker. It was like suddenly something went on in me. I said, I don't want to smoke anymore. And I tried to quit once on my own, I couldn't do it. Then I enrolled in some program, I quit.
Well, now, for those of you who have tried to quit smoking, particularly around this organization, let me tell you, you're not going to get a lot of support.
Because the very first thing that happened to me, and it's happened to all the people that I know I'm close to who have done the same thing, is all these feelings that the nicotine holds down begin to come up. It's nothing new. It's all very old stuff. You know, it's like, you get a little edgy.
Things that normally didn't upset you now drive you stark raving mad, right? To the point of lunacy with clenched jaws.
It's like Henry comes in from work at his normal time on a weekday like he always does, and he's not smoked for 3 days, walks through the living room, grabs his wife by the apron, pulls her into the living room and says, Martha, I hate that goddamn green couch. And Martha says, but Harold, the green couch has been there for 15 years.
I know, and I have hated that green couch for 15 years.
But you kind of like always have a cigarette, right? So when you get into this charming mood, people will always suggest that you smoke again. Short-lived, it really is. And I found, or at least for me it was, and once I got past that point, I found out I wanted to share the good feelings with people I cared about. Right? So I went to a friend of mine who I had known almost for the full 15 years I've been sober, and I sat down with her. We had had a brief one-and-a-half-week relationship, realized the error of our ways, and became friends. And I don't even want to get into short relationships and conquests, or that need, never mind. Anyhow, I sat down with her, I said, man, you got to try not smoking. It is the greatest thing, you know, all the new enthusiasm. When I first got clean and sober, I went to find some old street partners, you know, who weren't too interested in what I had discovered here. So I told her, I said, you've got to try it. It's really great. You'll love it. It's wonderful. You know, it's a neat thing. I'm starting to get some sense of something. I don't even know what, but I know that I feel like I'm coming to life, and it's a good feeling. And she said, yeah, right, okay, you know, maybe I'll give it a try. And she tried and had about 5 days, and then everybody in her business that she owned told her to smoke, right, again. And she started to smoke again, and I went back, and I said, no, please, you know, give it another shot. I really care about you. I think this is important. You know, all the facts are in. It will kill you. It's like this, people who are parked behind the Bounty restaurant are going to be told, you smoke, the odds are it'll probably kill you, you know. But let us not concern ourselves with that. So now I go to a meeting and I'm sitting there and she's at the podium and she's saying, you know, takes out the cigarette and lights it and says, I have a friend here who's a big advocate of not smoking, but I want the world to know that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober and stop drinking. I did not come here to stop smoking. I thought, Jesus, neither did I. I mean, I didn't come here to stop smoking either. I came here to start living, really.
You know, I really came here to stop dying. I had no idea what living was or what it was about or what it offered me. I knew nothing about living. I just didn't want to die anymore. And after being here for a while, energies began to come up that I wanted to live, right? So I went to her after. I said, you're just denial. You're just defending. I really care about you. Why don't you give it up? She called me in about a week and said, you know, my doctor told me I've got emphysema. I've got to do something about smoking. I came. I sat down with her. I said, what you got to do about it is give it up. All you gotta do is care enough about yourself to give it up. That's it. She said, I don't know. It's not really a big deal. Oh, that's lethal. Those words are lethal for me. When I say it's no big deal in my life, it's a lie. It's what it is a lie. So she decided it wasn't a big deal, and a year later I spent a lot of time sitting in her hospital room in Cedars-Sinai Hospital watching her die. And she had to die. And I loved her. She was a special person, and I cared about her. And, you know, that's what it's about. Anyway, onward, let's get on to it. But that's the reality. I mean, I love to gloss all this bullshit over. As people say, well, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is no place to talk about not smoking. Hey, I'm here to talk about me and what's important to me and my recovery, and this is me, and this is what's important to me, and this is what's important to my recovery. So now I'm 15 years sober. I'm not smoking. I got a great job. I go out and do it one more time. You know, marry one more time. It's the fifth time. And it didn't last any longer than any of the rest of them have lasted. And I moved to Santa Barbara to try and save the marriage, thinking, you know, small community, beach community, walk on the sand, and, you know, all that. Anything but give, well, I, you know, and people just kept saying, give me more, be intimate, be care about me, give me something. And I would stand there like, what do you want? You know, what do you mean be intimate? I had no idea what it meant. I had no yardstick for intimacy. There was never any intimacy between my parents. There was never any intimacy between them and me. And I had no idea what the hell any of it was. So that marriage ended too. So now I'm 17 years sober. And if you looked at my outside life, you'd say, gee, this guy's got it made. 17 years sober, driving an expensive car, living in a penthouse apartment at the beach, another 25-year-old, 11 months sober. God. 11 months sober girlfriend, you know, and... in a good job in the studio, paying me a lot of money. And I wanted to die. I wanted to die. I had no sense of value. I had no sense of that I was doing anything good with my career. I had no sense of relationship. One more time, I had one more person looking at me saying, give me more. And I didn't know what the more was, and I didn't know where to go to get it. And so I looked at the book again, and I read the book again, and I looked at the steps again, and I tried to think, could I write one more new inventory after writing 32 inventories, and I couldn't think of anything new to say other than here I am one more time in the same kind of situation that I didn't even want to be in. And you know, the thing that was a really part of a tragedy of it for me was inside of me was a little guy. Every time I would go dancing across the room to start one of these relationships, there's a little guy inside of me said, hey, we don't want to do this. This isn't any good for us. Wait. Yeah, right? The mind would say, quiet, man, just stay down there and shut up. You know, say, mind your manners. Don't interfere in things that are no concern of yours, right? I had no idea what the little voice was, so I ignored it. Like I had ignored my instincts all my life. Okay? I can reflect back now on my whole life and think of hundreds of times that I was about to do something and an instinct inside of me said, no. And I would just walk right on by the instinct, right into whatever it was, marriage, divorce, employment, quitting a job, whatever. I would ignore the instinct. You see, because one of the things I've learned about listening to instinct in me, listening to my intuition, is I must be willing to be spontaneous. And in order to be spontaneous, I must be willing to risk looking bad. And in order to risk looking bad, I must care enough about myself that I know if I look bad, I'm still okay. So that if you catch me in the streets in my shorts, because my house is burned down, I'm still okay as a human being. Me, Bob, as a human being, has not been diminished by the fact that I'm standing here in my jockey shorts talking to you in the middle of the street. It's the same thing with hitting the wall and turning left. Spontaneous. In order to do that, in order to just stroll out the door, take God's hand when I hit the wall, be willing to take a risk and turn left, right? Into the unknown. You know why I can't do that? I can't do that because I discovered not long ago I have an almost impossible time doing anything I haven't experienced before. Okay? Now, that will limit your life a lot. It's not that the opportunities didn't come, it's just that I couldn't partake. People would come to me and say, hey, none of us have ever been to the what do you call it. Let's all go to the what do you call it and see what goes on. Oh, God, I really can't. I'd like to, but I made plans. I got to pick a couple of new guys up and get them down to detox, or I'd be glad to go with you. And they would all go off and experience what do you call it. And I'd go home alone and watch TV because I knew how to do that. I had done that before. And I wasn't at risk, because there wasn't enough of me to be at risk. So when the suggestion was made, when I was sitting here 17 years sober with what appeared to be a wonderful life and wanting to die, to seek out therapy, I went. Now, I had always been open-minded to therapy. Anybody I sponsored who went into therapy, I fired immediately. I had just said, look, obviously whatever it is I have to offer you isn't sufficient, so why should we burden ourselves with this relationship any longer? I wish I could have talked to the girls like that. It would have been great. Could have saved a fortune. So I go to this lady, and we sit down, and she says, tell me about yourself, starting with your childhood. I said, when I was 15 years of age, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School. I began to use narcotics and drink alcohol. I spent the next 11 years of my life running the streets, smuggling narcotics from Mexico in and out of institutions. I came to AA at 26 years of age, and I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 years. She looked at me and she said, I said, tell me about yourself starting with your childhood. You were not born at 15 years of age. I looked at her and said, I don't remember it. She got that look, you know, that look they get, that like, the opportunity to write a paper sits right in front of them. Because I was 17 years sober sitting in AA meetings, and somebody would get up at an AA meeting and say, geez, you know, so-and-so said such and such to me, and it hurt my feelings. And I didn't know what they meant. I didn't know what they meant. I didn't know what it meant to have the feelings hurt. I didn't know. Of course, the state of California had criminal psychiatry said I had a couple of problems, but I didn't know what they meant. I watched this very scary thing the other night on this guy, Lucas, or whatever the hell his name is, the guy that's confessed to 300 and some odd murders. And they asked him what he felt, you know, when he did it. He said, nothing. Well, how long were you guilty or upset about it after it happened? He said, not at all. Once the killing was done, he walked away. I thought, God, I remember being 17 years sober and not really feeling much of anything. I thought, oh, Jesus, feelings, you know, are so important to me. So this lady and I began a process of going back to finding out why I could not remember anything from 15 years of my life except falling out of a second-story window when I was 4 years old into a cement gutter on my head and swallowing a bolt out of the playpen and winning a gold medal in the Junior Olympics when I was 12 years old and crying. This is the second time I could remember crying. And what we went back and we found out is I am the product of a typical home, it seems, of most people, the majority of people, as far as I can tell, in Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic parent, one non-alcoholic parent. And the thing that began to uncover is that if you were raised in that kind of household, you're not raised like a normal kid. It is no normalcy in an alcoholic household. And it's like, God, you know, and I meet people now and I talk to people now around the program just absolutely, I sit sometimes and cry with people because people will come up and they will tell you about this childhood. I'll be 10 years sober and they will have been raised by two alcoholic parents and they will have been beaten and battered and tied up and burned and destroyed and taken to hospital after hospital near dead. And yet they've not said a word about it. Like it doesn't matter. Now, to say that that doesn't matter, you know, well, I don't know. I mean, I can only talk about me. What I began to discover is the first thing that you lose, or I lost being raised by the dynamic duo that raised me, is a personality of any kind. No identity. I was not allowed an identity. The only identity I could have was formulated. I became a peacekeeper. I became whatever the situation required me to become to keep them from killing me or each other. That's what I became. And how did that affect me in later life? In later life, both drinking, using, and sober in AA, anytime I was stuck in a situation with a room full of people I didn't know, when I would first walk into that room, I would have to stand back against the wall. And the reason I had to stand back against the wall is because I had to watch you guys to see how you talked to each other. I had to see how you stood, your posture, listen to the tone of the voice, hear how you laugh, you know, just find out how you did it. And once I was comfortable with how you did it, then I could come off the wall, walk out into the room, and put my hand out and say, hi, I'm Bob Earl, how are you? The tragedy of that is that whoever really is Bob Earl, I left back on the wall. See? And I left him back on the wall because he wasn't good enough to bring out to meet you. So I had to create somebody. I had to create somebody. I wasn't enough, right? Two of the other things I learned is no emotional extremes are allowed, or they weren't in my house. Crying? Right, guys? You remember being a little guy? Those of you who can remember through the fog of your childhood. You fall down, you scrape your knee, your skin is hanging off of it, you come bopping into the house, you got tears streaming down your face, the pain is immersed, the old man's drunk, and you say, oh God, my ears, and Dad says, and you know, the typical macho bullshit, stop crying, it's not a big cut.
I can't stop crying, it's goddamn killing me, it really hurts, Daddy, honest to God, I can't stop crying.
Knock off the crying or I'll give you something to cry about.
I can't stop crying.
Then you say,
okay, I got that one. Right? I have laid in the Georgia Street Receiving Hospital in Los Angeles City and had them pull bullets out of it with no goddamn pain medication of any kind. Just said, fuck you. Because I learned tough guys don't cry, you know. You girls wonder why we have so much trouble expressing our feelings sober in AA? Guess why? I was never allowed to express them, and I was never allowed to laugh. You know, did you ever get in a giggling fit in an alcoholic household? It's dangerous, baby, because the alcoholic is paranoid and he knows who you're laughing at. You know.
couldn't laugh, and no wonder I didn't know how to get down inside and feel any feelings and cry. And keep the whole story really short. It was like, it's like what I learned is that
I just never knew I counted for anything, you know?
Some of the memories that I began to come up with put me in such a state of rage that I couldn't believe it.
I went through a thing with some doctors. I was starting to run, and I was having trouble with my foot, and it was driving me crazy because I kept running on the side of my foot. I couldn't understand why I was running on the side of my foot. So finally I went to a foot doctor. I won't bore you with the three quacks I went to before I finally went to the good guy that everybody suggested I should go to in the first place, right? And I couldn't do that. First I had to go to the guy down the street, you know, and then I had to go to the brunette, you know, down the hall because she was also a foot doctor, right?
You know, so anything but take me to the guy who's the real pro because I'm not worth taking to him. I'll drive you to him. Me, I'll go see Freddie Farquacker down the street, right?
Here's my body, Fred. Do whatever you want. You know, I know there's a guy better than you 12 blocks across town, but I just can't go. You know, it's a, I don't care. So I'm sitting with his doctor, and his doctor says to me, well, you know, he says, what you have here, he says, is practically a club foot. Did you have any problem with your feet when you were a child? I said, no. Not that I know of. And I go home. And after he said that, I'm really upset inside. I mean, I got all kinds of stuff going on inside. I don't know what it is, but I know it's feelings, and I know it's there. And by this point, I've had enough therapy to know it's okay to have feelings, even though I can't put a cause on them. They're just there, right? And I get home, and this thing's really got me upset. And God's time is wonderful, because my mother calls, right? Who has just come from her foot doctor. And she's telling me about how it was a stand-in, and he did her toenails wrong, right? I said, Mother, was there ever any problem with my feet when I was little that I don't know about? She says, no, not really. We just had high arches and required special shoes, but it was, you know, no big deal. So now I hang up the phone and I'm homicidal and I don't know why. I don't know why. I have no idea why. I just want to kill somebody, you know. I'm out driving through traffic looking for somebody to cut me off so I can become a lunatic, right? So I go see my therapist the next morning and I tell her about this and she says, well, why don't we go back there and see what the hell's going on and see what we can find out. Well, what we found was a 2-year-old little boy standing in a hallway with tears in his eyes and he's talking to his mother. And he says to his mother, he says, did his feet hurt? The shoe's too small. It's too small and his foot hurts. And his mother says to him, probably the thing she said more to me throughout the 14 years I was at home than anything else. Your dad might hear you and get mad. And it's at that point that I realized if I wasn't worth buying shoes for that fit. I mean, you think kids don't file that stuff? That thing doesn't register? Man, it registered with me because that's where my self-esteem came from. I got so much in touch with some of that stuff. When this last year during the Olympics, I probably went through 15 boxes of Kleenex, right? First of all, for those of you who don't know, one of the things I've discovered in this therapy, which is beautiful, is I was introduced to my own little kid who lives inside of me. Now, I have his picture on my television set at home. He's about 18 months old. He's got blonde curly hair. He's in a little sailor suit, and he's adorable. He's just adorable. He's got a dumb expression on his face. Totally uncool. Yeah. And sitting next to him is a picture taken of me this last year in Canada, that I didn't know was being taken, and it's the same face as the child. Yeah, I'm very proud of that picture. I'm very proud. You know, I was getting my hair cut the other day, and I looked in the mirror, because I learned to really like myself. I looked in the mirror while this guy was cutting my hair, and I used to not be able to look in the mirror, and forget that, look in the mirror and say, I love you. Oh, never. You know, I'd stare at myself in the mirror, and the anger would just grow over what an asshole I was. You know, I just could not say, I love you. Right? And I looked in this mirror while my hair was being cut, and I just smiled at myself, because I saw the face of a man in the eyes of a child. And it blew me away. Because I want that child. I want to live with that wonderment, that joy. But anyhow, one of the things I discovered about my child is that he loves teddy bears. So I have a house full of teddy bears, right? And the Olympics came on, and my child informed me that the bears also wanted to watch the Olympics. So if you had come into my manager had come into my apartment while I was out, while the Olympics were on, he would have thought I was over the edge, right? Because there was about 15 bears in the living room on the love seat and sofa with the TV on. And they were all watching the Olympics, and then in the bedroom in a half circle on the bed were the other 15 bears all sitting up watching the TV set in the bedroom, watching the Olympics. And my partner in living up here is from Canada, so I had some American bears and some Canadian bears, and the Canadian bears had Canadian flags so they could cheer for the... So now on the days that I'm sitting down home with my bears watching the Olympics, I did more crying than I've done through anything in my life. And what was going on with me was very simply this. Some young man would get up and he'd get ready to do his event, whatever it was. And prior to doing his event, they would do a little like side story on him. You know, this is who he is and where he's from and about his parents and his hometown and all that. And they'd say, Tommy here is going to compete in such and such an event, and his mother and father rode all the way to California from Minnesota on a motorcycle to be here, just to watch him participate. And I'd start to cry. See, because the kid didn't even stand a chance of winning the event, and everybody knew it. You know, there was like five other people in the event, 10 times better, but they had rode all the way from Minnesota on a motorcycle to watch this child participate. And our tears started to come. The reason the tears started to come is because, man, I remembered Father and Son's Day at school, and nobody showed up. And I remember Mother and Son's Day, and nobody showed up. And I remember Parent-Teacher Day, and nobody showed up. There was nobody there. And I'd watch another kid, and he'd get ready to participate in an event. And the parents, the guy and his father, would work 4 hours overtime or a night or something for 2 years to provide the additional funds because he believed in this kid so much in what he was doing. And they interviewed the parents, and the parent and the son, and what his dad had taught him was very simple. Daddy was beautiful, and he was wonderful, and he was important, and he didn't need to do anything except just be. That as is, he was okay. He didn't have to wear a certain kind of clothes or talk a certain kind of way or drive a certain kind of car or have a certain kind of job. He was okay. And I would cry. And then that kid, that beautiful kid who had had Hodgkin's disease, the wrestler who won the gold medal, and broke down and sobbed like a baby on national television. I mean, you know, 20 million, 80 million, 100 million people watching. He wasn't worried about looking foolish. He didn't care about looking good. He had done something wonderful. And I would cry because I could remember the pain. And the other side of it was every time one of these guys would win their event, I would cry. My kid was like, yeah, wow, man. And we'd cry immense tears of joy. Immense tears of joy. And then I watched a situation that really got me going. There was this kid who was a swimmer. And he came to the Olympics. He missed them 4 years before because the Carter holdout. He had come back. He trained for 4 more years. He had hung in there. And he came with one goal in mind. Break the world's record. Announced it before the event. I am here to break the world record. You know, that's what I'm going to try and do. Break the world record. No fear of looking bad in this kid, man, you know. Oh, I'll just do the best I can.
swim okay. I'm going to do it. I'm going to break the world's record. Well, he gets in the pool. The event comes. He swims his ass off, right? He wins the race. He wins the gold medal. He breaks the Olympic record, and he looks at the clock, and he has not broken the world record. And the disappointment was visible on his face. He was really upset. And when the sports writers interviewed him afterwards in his tent, he was still upset. You must be thrilled. You won the gold medal and you broke the Olympic record. No, not really. It wasn't as good as it could have been. I'm really not that pleased with how it turned out. You know, it's kind of, and he was bummed out, right? Now, if you think we live in a healthy society, the sports writers of America rode this poor kid's ass so bad that the following day he issued a public apology for his behavior. And in case anybody out there doesn't know it, having a goal, announcing a goal, trying for the goal, and if you fall short, being disappointed is good mental health. Healthier than my standing around when the guys are going to whatchamacallit and I have to say, gee, I have two newcomers to pick up, I can't go. And I take me home and sit down in front of the TV set because I'm afraid to risk, because I'm afraid to look bad, because there's not just a whole lot of me here. The process, what has transpired in this process has been, in meeting the child, I also had to meet the adolescent. He's Episcopal. I'll tell you about the adolescent. He's just a whole world of fun, he is. You guys all know who he is, right? He's the one when you're driving down the streets giving you a whiplash. Last year, when I went to Hawaii to run this marathon, I had trained a year. Something I really wanted to do was run a marathon. Now, I'm not fast. I'm no gazelle. I don't have a running style that looks like Alberto Salazar. I mean, my body's in bad shape. The pelvis has been snapped in half and put back together. I have fused vertebrae. I have a short leg. I have a crushed hip on the other. I mean, I took it in the back all of my life, right? So I even run kind of, wobbly, right? So I'm not even, won't want you to even begin to think that I went with any kind of idea of finishing before 5 hours, at that. But I just wanted to finish. My kid and I want to go run this marathon. And I trained and worked hard and, I ate right and slept right and did it and didn't kill myself and got up. The last run I made before I left for Hawaii was 22 miles. I left 2 weeks early. This trip was for me. Took me and a couple of bears, and I want to be there 2 weeks early. A running bear. He has a little running outfit on. And Bear, who, has been around forever. So I took these bears and I get there and it's like, God, I'm 2 weeks early to get used to the humidity and I'm not using any air conditioning in the rental car. I'm not using any air conditioning in the hotel. I mean, I'm really trying to do it right. I'm trying to be responsible. And so I work out with very light weights at home, just to come some aerobic weight workout. And I thought, well, I need a gym in Hawaii for 6 workouts, prior to this, to the race. So I call around. I finally find a gym that'll let me come in and work 6 times, some, super sports, fantastic center in Honolulu. So I stroll into the super sports, fantastic center in Honolulu and make arrangements to work out 6 times and walk through the magic doors. And I'm confronted with knotless machinery, which I've never seen before in my life, right? Because I use free weights at home. Now, come on. There were instructors all over this place, right? There were guys looking like Mr. America in their t-shirts with staff written in. There was adorable little girls in their little dolphin shorts with their little tank tops with staff embroidered over the left breast, right? There was, God knows, plenty of people to walk up and say, how does this machinery work, right? Right? us and looked around, right? At the Mr. Americas. And these adorable little girls in their dolphin shorts. And he says, hey, we're cool. Walked right over to the machine he didn't know a goddamn thing about. Looked familiar and similar to one at home. Went to do some leg curls and I felt the knee go on the machine. So I go to the running doctors in Hawaii and they say, well, it may be gone, it may not be gone. I love modern medicine, they're really right there. It may be gone, may not be gone. You may have torn cartilage, may not have torn cartilage. Maybe a ligament. Jesus, I don't know. Maybe it's a tendon, you know, put some ice on. I said, well, can I use this? Yeah. So I went back to my hotel room. I spent the next 10 days taking care of myself. I can't tell you what a miracle that is. Because I couldn't even keep a plant alive 5 years ago. You know, no wonder I couldn't have a relationship, you know. Plants died automatically, you know. And I look around, they want more goddamn water, you know. It's like... What do you want from me, for Christ's sakes? You know, I so now I'm stuck over there and I have to take care of me. I take care of me and I nurse the knee and the ice and I put the medicine on anyway. I went out and tried to run the marathon. I got 18 miles and the knee went and that was it. Goodbye, Charlie. I was able to hobble in the last 8 and finish, but it was really a bummer, but that's how much fun the adolescent can be, you know, and he has to look good. He can't ask anybody anything because, you know, I used to, people who had any self-esteem who could ask questions used to embarrass me in public. You know, you go out to a restaurant with him, and a son of a bitch will sit there with a menu, and he'll say to the waiter, excuse me a minute, what is this, pâté de foie gras here? I'm thinking, oh man. You know, did you have to ask, for Christ's sakes? You know, couldn't you just order goddamn shrimp cocktail or something? You know, I mean, now the whole restaurant and the waiter know you don't know what it is. Of course, I didn't know either. But I wasn't going to ask. I was going to spend the next 20 years not knowing rather than ask. You know, I used to eat a lot of sushi and I never would ask. I'd stay with the stuff that was safe. And people would order these weird, exotic looking things. I'd never ask. Some guys would say, they'd stand up in the goddamn, at the shrimp bar, lean over. I mean, everybody in the restaurant can see them. Say, what's this here? I go, oh, God. You know. I used to eat meals. I'm talking about, forget drinking and using. Sober, I ate so many meals I didn't order. You know. And food, it was cold. Because I couldn't send it back. Because I didn't deserve what was right or what was proper or what was okay or what was ordered. There wasn't enough self-esteem there to get that stuff. So I met the child, I met the adolescent, I met the adult. I love the adult. I finally met him. He's great. I enjoy him immensely. He's a good man. He's a good man. He's a gentleman. Okay, now guys, here we go, right? When I began to feel a softening taking place inside of me in therapy, I began to get very frightened. And the lady said to me, why? What is the matter? What are you afraid of? And I said, I'm afraid that I'm going to become a wimp. I'm afraid that if I really let people know how I feel, they'll take advantage of me. They'll hurt me. And I don't want to live like that. You know, that was a horrible fear I had all my life, that if I became, and I really am a gentle person. I'm a very, very gentle person. And I have very tender feelings inside of me. And I have a lot of feelings about a lot of things. I went to the therapy for 4 years. Oh, the other guy's always still there. The fourth voice is always there. You know, I mean, he's there in the morning to greet me. Good morning. I waited to talk to you. This is going to be the worst day of your life. all the program, all the nutrition, all the therapy is not going to get you through this one. You know, and occasionally he still catches me off guard, man, and I go absolutely whippo, you know, I go really crazy. Last year, I had an interesting experience last year. I'm just trying to share with you what's been going on with me, and, you know, since I was so, I had the worst financial year I've had in a long time. I mean, bottomed out, man, absolutely bottomed out. Complete 3 seconds away from bankruptcy. I tell you one of the reasons is an advantage to take care of yourself. Here the first part of the year, or last year, I don't know about you, right, but I'm one of these guys who believes in the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Okay? I mean, I send in the publisher's clearinghouse, you know. I take Reader's Digest, I never read it, you know, and I enter all their sweepstakes knowing that I'm going to win. When I'm broke, I go to the mailbox looking for the letter from that's telling me that dear Aunt Harriet has died and left me enough to keep me forever. Now, I don't have an Aunt Harriet, but I don't care. I know she's going to die. Even to the point when I was in the midst of this financial crisis, the day I came from my business manager's office and he had said to me, I'd love to pay the bills, but you have to give me some money first. And, you know, we're 3 months behind on the world, right? So I'm driving down the street with this, depressed. And I was really depressed. I was depressed. I was scared. I'd forgotten my spiritual, you know, any spiritual sense or trust or faith in God. I was just totally goddamn panicked. I knew I was on a blacklist at One Network. I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And I look in my rearview mirror, and behind me is this really old Cadillac limousine. And it's being driven by a driver who was around when the Cadillac limousine was new. And in the back seat is a very old, little old lady. And my spirits just improved. You know, it was like I knew that in a block or two, he was going to honk his horn, flash his lights, have me pull over. The little old lady was going to get out, give me $1 million. I was going to fall down the street in tears, you know, to show my appreciation that she had found the right person. I turned left. They went straight. Right? So, but I believe in the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Okay? Firm believer. Well, the first part of last year, up in Canada, this couple, when Lois and I were up there, won the Canadian lottery, the big lottery. $14 million. Two things different about Canada's lottery from ours. A, tax-free. B, they give it all to me at once. Okay? This guy and his wife have just won $14 million. That'll take the heat off. Right? Might even pay off all the ex-wives. He was not in good health. He had not taken care of himself, and 6 weeks after he won the money, he died. That's it. He got his pot of gold. One of the reasons I enjoy taking care of myself today is I may not hit Publisher's Clearinghouse till I'm 70. You know. But I goddamn sure want 20 years left when I hit it. You know what I mean? I don't want to go out in 6 weeks, let me tell you. No way do I want to go out in 6 weeks. Anyhow, I was having the worst year. There was no money. I was in a panic. I was trying to pray, meditate. I'd get up in the morning, and I had, throughout different periods of my sobriety, I'm a seeker. You know, I'm going to go out, and I will go to this ashram or down to the Self-Realization Fellowship, or I'll learn this kind of meditation or this kind of meditation, and I will structure my day and sit for 4 hours. And, I mean, I went through all that, 8, 9 years sober in there. Probably kept me into the 10th year. But anyhow, it's like I knew how to meditate. I knew how to get quiet. I knew how to achieve hours of silence. It's not like it was brand new to me at this point. And I'd get out in my living room, I'd sit down, and I'd fold my legs behind my hands, and I'd sit there, and I couldn't get quiet. I was like, God, the voices and the panic. It's like, oh, shit, what are you going to do? You know, if Chase Manhattan isn't tolerant, it's bankruptcy. You know, first interview of the app, the list went on. You know, who could sing to me with one phone call? You know, and I'm like, crazy. I'm trying to get quiet. I can't get quiet. I feel like a jerk, you know. And my immediate thing is my instinct, and this is very difficult, man, those of us raised in an alcoholic household, man, is what's wrong with me? You know, what did I do wrong? I'm bad. What's wrong with me? And I could not get silent. I had one of my best friends spending time with me. This guy and I have been through, Jesus, through all of it. Through all of it. I mean, this guy I love and I adore. I mean, when Taylor was so sick with the cancer and they gave her, one of the people she went to had a purging thing where you had to drink like Epsom salts for 3 days, right? And totally just purge and wipe out your body. And this guy who was my best friend was, and his wife were staying with us at the time, and Tommy said, look, Taylor, just so you don't feel alone, I'll drink the Epsom salts with you, glass for glass, for 3 days. And he did. And that's how much I love him. And he was there, and he was trying to help me, you know, and I'm trying to get quiet. Finally, I'm sitting talking to my therapist, saying, I'm going nuts. Nuts. You know, this goddamn financial thing has got me absolutely crazy. You know, and there's a part of me that says, You know, you're not going to get a cherry. I've been here before. You know, what's the big deal? Relax. In another party, I can't. You know, I don't know what to do, and I'm trying to meditate, and I can't. She leaned forward at me, and she went, shh. Bobby. Shh. Be quiet. I went, oh, God. And I wasn't good because I couldn't get quiet. She said an interesting thing to me. She said, I'd rather have you walk on the beach. I'd rather have you get up and walk in a park. I'd like to have you talk out loud to God. I'd rather have you do anything. Anything. Then, shh, for right now. For right now. And that's, you know, one of the things I'm learning is to be spontaneous. So I get up the next morning, man, I'm walking through the house, right? We have a serious problem here, Bob. We are about to go under, you and I. And I don't know if you care, but goddamn, it's got me scared to death, you know. And I just got some energy going and got some noise going, and it was okay to get a little loud and talk to God and make a little noise. You know, and finally now, I get up in the morning, I go in the living room, I sit and I talk. It's a year later now, and things have turned around. You know, it's starting to turn around. I can see it turning around. I can feel it turning around. But I still talk out loud, and I'm loving it. I say all my prayers out loud. I start the day with the Lord's Prayer. It has a lot of value to me. It brings me down. Well, you're totally broke, man. It really helps to get brought down to right now. You know? I have my daily bread, you know. It's okay. It's coming around. It's coming around. I'm even maybe getting ready to take some risks. I don't know. And try some big kid stuff. We'll see. I hope so. I hope I can do that now. I hope I have enough self-esteem. What am I like today? Well, God, just to tell you, I believe that nutrition and mental health are linked like this. You know, I've had some experiences now that my eating is really terrible, where I occasionally, what the hell? Let's have some dates covered in chocolate. I mean, giving up smoking was great because then I put on 40-some pounds, right? So then sugar had to go because sugar became the big. I mean, I used to sit home. Sit home in the house at 11, at 10:45 at night. I'm not going to eat any sugar tonight. It's it's no goddamn problem for me. I don't have any. Sugar's just some little old, plant of nature. It's no big goddamn deal. Boy, at 10:55, I'm out the door, right? Driving 90 miles an hour to 31 flavors, you know. Go through the door just as the guy started to lock it, right? You got my pralines and cream butterscotch topping and dry roasted cashews. So when I went nuts trying to get off that, get rid of the weight, somebody finally said, every time you want sugar, eat an apple. I said, oh, okay, I'll try that. I did, though. That was about 5 years ago. Thank God. It worked. So I don't eat sugar. I don't eat red meat. I don't drink any caffeine of any kind, any diet colas. I don't drink coffee. I rarely even drink tea. I eat basically a vegetarian or macrobiotic diet. I eat some fish. Occasionally, if stuck, I will eat chicken. I'm not rigid. Rigidity will kill me. I create immense bars around me to live in. Jesus, I don't even have. Never mind. Another time we'll go into kindness and flexibility I have with me. You know, I really beat me up. So as I stand here today, you know, it's like I'm full of feelings. Sometimes I get up, I'm walking through my living room, I begin to cry for no reason. No reason, just a feeling, and it's okay. It's fine. I don't know where the sadness is coming from, and I don't care. It's me. It's who I am. And I've become convinced I am my feelings. I am my feelings. That's who I am. I can't think of what else I am. I can't think of what else I am. If I'm not my feelings, what the hell am I? I mean, I'm not my car. I mean, I'm certainly not my car. I've had a couple of those repossessed, you know. I'm not my job. I'm not what I do. I didn't do much of that last year, which means I was zero for, you know, well, except 3 weeks of last year. I'm not my clothes. I'm not the clothes I wear. God knows I'm not my personality. I can change that for social events, you know. What one do you want today? You know, it seems the only thing that has its own motor going is my feelings. My feelings have their own engine. They come up. The child has a lot of feelings. And children are wonderful. I love watching children. You ever watch children? Children trust their instincts. Watch a kid in a room full of people, man. You know, they're beautiful. You know, somebody else, child will start going over towards Uncle Harry in a family gathering. You know, get within 3 feet of Uncle Harry and he'll go. Is anybody allowing that? No, come on, Bobby. Say hi to Uncle Harry, you know. Shove him up in Uncle Harry's lap. I was talking with some friends at Laguna here a couple of weeks ago, and I had just finished reading his book. I mean, the name of it, I've been trying to think of it. I can't. But anyhow, said a very interesting thing about it, and they were summing it up for me. It was written by a German psychologist, a woman, and she had said, in essence, if you're, you know, all the focus is always on Jesus. You know, it's always on Jesus. And she said, yeah, if you want to talk about parenting, you should focus on Mary and Joseph. For Mary and Joseph were the perfect parents. You see, they knew they were raising the Son of God. And although sometimes they didn't understand where he was going, and what he was doing frightened them, they learned from him. They let the child lead them. You see, this is what children are for. You know, we should learn from the children. I love watching kids today. The more childlike I can get, I like it. So anyhow, today a guy stand before you, and I gotta tell you, I am pleased to be me. I now occasionally walk by a mirror and catch a look at myself, and I wink at me because I see a nice guy, and I like him. And I can't tell you what an incredible feeling it is to be able to do that. I believe in exercise. I believe in a lot of things. I believe all these things are important. I think it's time we're going to have to take issue and look at them, you know. We can't keep our heads in the sand forever, man. I'm convinced that, you know, if Bill and Dr. Bob were to find AA today in 1985, that therapy and nutrition and exercise would be an integral part of the program because they were way ahead of their time then. I can't see what you're saying. The book says God will constantly disclose more to us. Constantly disclose more. And there's a lot being disclosed about the value of these things. The number one reason you will give yourself for not doing any of this is the number one reason I gave myself. Now let me get one other quick point. It's a long haul, man. You know, it's like I've been storing this stuff now for a couple years, really, seriously. And if you think it's a breeze, and the older you are, forget it, right? You know, like I started at about 47, okay. And now when you haven't done sit-ups for 47 years... And you begin to do sit-ups. It is an interesting experience, okay? With a bad back. I mean, I could barely get my shoulder blades that far off the floor. It took me 7 months to just get to the point where I could do the sit-up that you do when you have a bad back, which is this far off the floor. Okay? It's taken a long time. It takes patience. You know, it takes a lot. Be kind to yourself. Be patient with yourself. Because I have a voice in me that says, well, we worked out for 3 goddamn months. We do not look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, so fuck it. You know, let's give it up. I'm always ready to quit things, right? God, just be patient. Because, like, I figure now, for almost 50, I'm in great shape, okay? But this ain't the end. My goal is I want to be in better shape when I'm 51. I want to be in better shape still when I'm 52. I want to be in better shape still when I'm 53. I don't figure that getting sober is the end. I think getting sober is the beginning. If you're like I was in the beginning when I started to get this information and this kid inside of me started saying, yeah, let's do it. You know, I want to be around a while. Let's go for it, right? The very first words out of me to me were, forget it. It's too late. That's too late, man. You're too old. Just give it up. A couple of years ago, I was watching a sporting event on TV. And they were interviewing this guy before this event. And he was telling the interviewer that when he was 65 years old, he was living home with his son. And his son came into his room one morning and he said to him, Dad, I'm going to have to take you and put you in a home. And his dad said, no, I don't want to go to a home. I do not want to be put in a home, ever, you know. And his son said, look, all you do is sit here all day. You smoke cigarettes, you eat crap. You're sitting here dying. Dying. It's not good for me. It's not good for you. It's not good for my wife. It's not good for your grandkids. We're gonna have to do something. And his dad said, look, I will do anything, anything to not be put into a home. His son said, all right, get up in the morning and come run with me. So I got up early the next morning to go running with his son, and he ran a quarter of a block, maybe 10 yards, and he could go no further. His legs were weak and almost gave out, and he couldn't breathe, and his heart was pounding. He thought he was going to die. And his son said to him, okay, never mind, go home, go back to bed, we'll talk about it later, but we're going to have to do something. His dad got up the next morning and went out and did a quarter of a block again, and the next morning and did a quarter of a block, and it took him 3 months to get to a mile. And at the end of 3 months, the old guy had run 1 mile. And when he ran the end of that mile, when he completed that first mile, somehow the denial dropped away, and he took an immense risk because he looked at his life and he said, if I am in this terrible condition, my whole life must have been wrong. And he was willing to accept that. So he went out and bought some books on God and positive thinking, and he gave up his smoking, and he bought some books on nutrition, and he kept getting up every morning without even talking to his kid and going out and running. When I was watching him be interviewed, he was 83 years old, and he was in New York City to run his 14th New York Marathon. Just a little old man who was going to be put into a home. So, you know, if I have anything that I want to share or try and leave, it's first, I'm just grateful to have been here. It's the energy is wonderful, man. I can't tell you how much I love it. And if this old man can be an example, if the time is right for you today, that these things are important to you, maybe it's just not too late. You know? God bless you. Yeah.